Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Tim Phillips, who's going to co-host our review section. It's, you know, about, I think we've done this about six or seven times now. It's going like a well-oiled machine. I'm not sure how many more of these we'll have to do like this. We're kind of talking about reopening things slightly, at least here in Ontario. Who knows, you know, what's going to happen in the grander scheme of things. One thing that is open today is my window. I record at my desk, which is right by my window, and so you may hear some traffic sounds. It is spring, and I do like the fresh air, so just be advised, I am not doing this while driving. I am not broadcasting and driving, so just so we're clear. Okay. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the haunting new romantic drama Atlantics, which is from Africa and is now streaming on Netflix. If you don't have Netflix, it's actually coming to the Criterion Collection at some point. It's one of the Netflix movies and the big deal that Criterion made to secure. And like Marriage Story is the first one, and it's coming out, I think, in the summer sometime. It also called Irishman, and I think a couple of others. But I think most of us have Netflix, so by all means, shuffle over to Netflix and watch Atlantics. Listen to the review first, and maybe see if it is your speed. That's going to be in the back half of the show, of course. For the first half, we're going to continue our list of the top 40 comic book movies of the last 40 years. Last week, we did 40 to 31. Next week, we are doing 20 to 11. And this week, we are doing 30 to 21. I hope that maybe some of your favorites have appeared so far. As I said, I started with a list of about 227 and pared it down to 40, the best 40, in my humble opinion. Maybe you'll feel same about some of the picks. So why don't we start at number 30? I have Wonder Woman, and of course it's kind of timely, because in a few weeks' time, the good timeline, we were going to see Wonder Woman 1984, which is the sequel to Wonder Woman, which came out in 2017, directed by Patty Jenkins. So here you have, like, the first big-budget solo female superhero movie directed by a female director. Kind of landmark in a great number of ways. Fun fact, the first episode of End Credits, we reviewed Wonder Woman. And I wonder how many of us remember that. It was probably a pretty rough show, all things considered. It's not, by all means, perfect. I think the ending is very, very clunky. But I think there is indisputable power in the film. And I know that a lot of people, when the film came out, talked about online and on Twitter about, you know, getting a little teary in that scene where Diana appears in full Wonder Woman regalia for the first time, climbing out of the trench and taking on the soldiers, that sort of really feeling that moment. And I admit I felt it too. I think I was a bit more up on Wonder Woman than either of the two female panelists we had on that episode. But I think it's a very strong entry. It is certainly a very historic entry. And I think there's no denying that it, you know, there's a reason why Wonder Woman resonated in a way that, like, the previous DC movies in sort of that expanded universe, Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, and Man of Steel, kind of didn't. Wonder Woman stuck out like a sore thumb. It really sort of gave Warner Brothers and the people at the studio and DC Comics the idea that sort of dark wasn't the way to go to this, that having a character who was light and direct and fun was, you know, the better option. And you see the DC movie since, particularly Aquaman and Shazam, really kind of picking up on that idea. I mean, Wonder Woman still suffers from, let's say, Snyderitis, but if you've seen the trailer for Wonder Woman 1984, that is over. So I'm still looking forward to it. It's still supposed to come out in August now, but we'll see what happens with all the COVID stuff. My number 29 is X-Men, X2, X-Men United. The first X-Men movie really kind of laid the groundwork. It's you know, it's not great, it's not bad, though. It's, like, very much, like, a kind of a statement of principle. And, of course, you know the backstory of the first X-Men movie. It was very, very rushed. It was supposed to come out in the summer of, I think the holidays of the year 2000, and then they moved it up to summer of 2000. So, very, very rushed job, which sort of makes it amazing. It's as coherent as it is, given at the time this was Bryan Singer's first big budget film. But X2 takes things way up a notch. You have, like, such great action sequences, like the Nightcrawler attack on the White House, the Wolverine Deathstrike fight near the end. It really taps into the things that make the X-Men X-Men, like, you know, the being, you know, basically superhero fugitives, being on the run, having to team up with enemies in order to fight bigger enemies. It really captured that feeling I loved from the original X-Men comics. Plus, it introduced my favorite X-Men, which is Nightcrawler. So a lot of fun. My number 28 is The Rocketeer, which is, if you know Joe Johnson from directing the first Captain America movie, The Rocketeer is kind of where all that was play-tested. It's set, like, in pre-World War II era. It has that zippy kind of, what am I thinking of? The serials of the time, that kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark feel. Understandable, Joe Johnson was an art director at Lucasfilm in the early 80s, so he worked on Empire Strikes Back. He was kind of like the originator of the Boba Fett design. He also worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark, so he's kind of steeped in that tradition. You have great casts, and a lot of these have great casts, obviously, a lot of these movies I'm talking about, but, you know, Billy Campbell plays, like, the square-jawed hero, the Rocketeer. You have Jennifer Connelly, sort of, you know, in her little post-Labyrinth phase, where she's, you know, she has this bombshell quality. She's incredibly gorgeous. Spends most of this movie in this amazing white satin dress. Very kind of straight out of the sort of the glam era of 1930s Hollywood. And then you have Timothy Dalton, who's, like, just, like, a couple of years after leaving James Bond, playing the Nazi villain. So it's a lot of fun. It plays so well with the themes and the ideas of the old serials. And yeah, it's a hoot. It's a hoot and a half. I'm not sure the effects totally hold up, but it's a lot of fun. Number 27. Something else that's a lot of fun, Thor Ragnarok. It's the good Thor movie, in other words. It's from Taika Waititi, who is, of course, coming back and making a fourth Thor movie, which is a kind of rarity in the Marvel schism. Usually they wrap them up with number three. We've had three Captain America movies, three Iron Man movies, but we're going through with a fourth Thor, and I think it's only because he manages to capitalize on the things that make the Thor movies so engaging and bring in some new elements. A lot of them comedic, of course, adding Mark Ruffalo as kind of a straight man to all this, playing the Hulk. A lot of fun having Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie, having a great sort of female hero. No disrespect to Jamie Alexander as Lady Sif, but she didn't get a big role in the previous Thor movies. You have Jeff Goldblum in there. You have Carl Urban. And, of course, you have the great Cate Blanchett as the villain. Plus, you have, you know, different cameos. Doctor Strange is in there. There's so much going on. Plus, there's, like, subtle digs about colonialism that, you know, really takes this up a notch. It's a thinking man's comedic superhero movie. Which is great. Number 26 is another Marvel movie, Black Panther. Again, this is like a landmark film because it's black superhero, predominantly black cast, directed by a black filmmaker. And there's a reason this made $1 billion. You would understand it making $1 billion just for that reason. because it's cultural, it's zeitgeisty, it's of the moment, but it's also a really great movie. It's got like, it's like, it combines like five different genres. You have like kind of a Shakespearean drama with this courtroom court intrigue kind of thing. You have a James Bond movie around the end of the first act. You have, of course, superhero stuff. Plus you have a pretty solid socio-political message in terms of, you know, where Wakanda is in the grand scheme of things. If there was such a place as Wakanda in the real world, what would its responsibilities be to its fellow Africans who have been spread around the world? Intricately fascinating. Plus, one of the better, and I know that's like a low bar, but Michael B. Jordan as Killmonger is definitely in the top three, I think, Marvel villains, if not in the top two. Number 25, and I'm rapidly running out of time here before we have to get to the review, so this may be a little bit of lightning round. Men in Black, which of course is nothing like the indie comic that inspired it, but it's a really great example of adaptation, sort of using what the comic book brought and repurposing and redoing it a different way. You had great chemistry with Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith as the two agents. At the time, which was state-of-the-art computer graphic effects, you sort of see the seams when you revisit Men in Black now, but I think it's still a lot of fun. The comedy holds. The characters hold. You have Vincent D'Onofrio as this bug wearing a human suit, which is just perfect at times. You know, some of his line readings are great. He's a great villain. The cast is so good, and the inside jokes about, you know, the Men in Black's conspiracy to cover up aliens on Earth and where that leads, it's just crackers. It's a very tight movie. Number 24 is Kick-Ass, which is Matthew Vaughn, who's also made X-Men First Class and Kingsman: The Secret Service. So he has, like, a really good sense of how to make a great comic book movie. Kick-Ass had to walk a very fine line between sort of high concept and camp, and it does that very, very well, and it's not easy. And you know how I know is go and watch Kick-Ass 2, because it's the same creators, like, in terms of, like, where the comic book came from. It's the same actors. It's the same sort of general concept. Shot in the same place in Toronto. It had a lot going on, but it shows you just, like, it's a study in how a director handles material. Matthew Vaughn got it. Jeff Wardlow did not, unfortunately, but the original Kick-Ass still stands. And the highlights in there, of course, are Chloe Grace Moretz as Hit Girl and Nicolas Cage as her father, Big Daddy. It's a lot of fun, very funny, very action-centric, filled with great gore. It's a lot of fun. Speaking of fun, number 23, Mystery Men. It's an all-star cast. Ben Stiller, William H. Macy, Paul Rubens, Eddie Izzard, who's playing like this kind of henchman leader of this gang called the Disco Boys, which makes absolutely no sense. Mystery Men is based on a Flaming Carrot comic. It's another kind of indie comic. Not exactly faithful, but a lot of fun. Frankly, this movie would not be out of place stacked between Thor Ragnarok and Deadpool, but it came out, sadly, 20 years too early, so it's kind of more of a cult film. Rewatching it, you have a very obvious sense that this was made in the 90s. There's a lot of, like, Schumacher, Batman-esque, let's call it bigness, over-the-topness, you know, these elaborate models of cities and that, you know, just have no practical reality. Of course, it takes place in Champion City, which is a fake city. Having said that, it looks like nothing else except out of Batman and Robin. And it's still fun, though. It's still a good laugh. The characters are fun. Their powers are silly. You know, Janine Garofalo as the bowler. Her father's skull is in a bowling ball, and it's she throws it and it whips around and it's mystically controlled. It's just bonkers, but fun. Number 22 is Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. And second appearance by Guillermo del Toro. Again, you know, if you're familiar with the Hellboy comic, Hellboy is not, the Guillermo del Toro Hellboys aren't exactly faithful, but he gets the vibe, he gets the funkiness, he gets the monsters. I would also say that the Golden Army cues up Shape of Water because there's a subplot about interspecies mating, let's say, and the results of that. And, you know, you have, you have a great cast. You have Ron Perlman, who was born to play Hellboy. He essays the character so well, he is Hellboy. And it's utterly disappointing that the series couldn't continue, that Hellboy 2 wasn't successful enough for anyone wanted to roll the dice on a Guillermo del Toro Hellboy 3, because it would have been really interesting to see where he goes with a third chapter after where he left things off in the second chapter. Very imaginative, a lot of fun, great creatures, great actors. I wish there was another, because, you know, if you've seen the Hellboy that came out last year, it really needed the touch of somebody like Del Toro. Okay, finally, number 21. American Splendor. It kind of combines like a documentary format with a dramatic format of the life of Harvey Pekar, who did this independent comic, American Splendor. He is kind of a classic curmudgeon. And it's a lot of fun because it's just a guy. It's just a guy's life. A guy struggling with, you know, negative thoughts in his head. It's, that almost makes it sound like Joker, but this is way better than Joker and far more grounded than Joker. And it just goes to show you that, you know, you can create community. You can find your place in the world, even if you are someone who maybe not necessarily feel like you fit in. You can find your people. And I think that's the lesson from Harvey Pekar's life. And it's just a lot of fun. It's great classic 90s indie cinema. And really enjoyable. Often overlooked as a comic book movie, too. Alright. So we'll have to leave that there. And we'll pick up the list next week. After our musical break here, we will do our review of Atlantics. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And all that glitters is blue. Oh, we should stop. Somebody once asked, can I spare some change for gas? He said, I need to get away from this place. I said, that's a concept. Could use some fuel myself, and we could all use a little change. Well, the years start coming, and they don't stop coming. Fed to the rules, and I hit the ground running. It didn't make sense to live for fun when your brain gets smart. It gets dumb, and there's so much to do. There's so much to see, so much wrong. Sen kabul etmeyen ilgisi. Yani korkuyor, ifa olamasam.
Hayata kabul etmeyen. Yatay da yatay da yatay da
yatay da yatay da
Kalau nak kena rasa tak, mana dia tak pandai berhenti sendiri.
Nampak.
Anda betul aja. Hai, betul. Mana aku malah baca.
Saya awak nak tuan.
Tunggu nak tuan. Mana? Semua kembali bana.
And that was a clip from Atlantics. It is the new film from Matty Diop, and it stars Meme Sané, Ibrahima Traoré, Miriam Gassama, Nicole Segu, Amadou Mabau, and Dianko Sembene. So we are now being joined by Tim Phillips again, from home, live from home, if that's a way of looking at this. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. Yeah, I'm getting used to my couch. It's really good. Has a nice impression of my butt on it right now, so that's great. How are you doing, Adam?
I'm sitting in my desk chair, which, I mean, I guess I'm further cementing the impression. I have an old, like, wood editor's chair. It's not like one of those, like, lean-back jobs, and it's not on wheels or anything. It's just, like, a really old-fashioned-y, sturdy wooden chair, which continues to serve me well.
Nice. Good for ergonomics, right?
Sure. My chiropractor has no complaints. So we are here to talk about Atlantics, which is a film from Senegal. Interesting note, it finished, there's really no second place at the Cannes Film Festival, but in 2019 it got the Grand Prix, which is basically the silver medal. You know which film got the Palme d'Or last year, of course, don't you, Tim?
Was it Parasite?
It was Parasite.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. You win. so, I mean, it shows you just, I guess, the pedigree of the film. Also, Mady Diop, the director, the first female black woman from Africa to not just place at Cannes in terms of winning a prize, but to actually be in competition. So it's a breakthrough in a lot of ways. So let's just talk about, again, this is your pick, Tim, and I want to give you a chance to explain to the people why this film caught your eye and why you wanted to review it.
Yeah, well, thanks, Adam. I actually watched this back in December. Kind of caught my eye. It's been on Netflix for a while. It's still on Netflix. Caught my eye as something different for sure, and I read a little bit about it, and I read about the director and how she did really well at the Cannes Film Festival, and the fact that it's a film taking place in Senegal, and it seemed like a very unusual plot, so it kind of caught my eye, and I watched it, and it the first time I watched it, I thought, you know, this is a really interesting film. The director definitely has a great future ahead of her. And second time, very similar thoughts. So it was a movie that really intrigued me. And I think if you're looking for something different, you know, outside of, you know, the documentary fare or, you know, the series on Netflix, if you're looking for a film, an unusual foreign film, I think, I'd definitely check this out. I liked it a lot. It wasn't like, I probably wouldn't put it in my top 10 for the year, but I thought it was very, very interesting film dealing with a lot of different issues. It wasn't always smooth in its depiction of the issues, but it's really interesting commentary on class system in Senegal, rich versus poor. It's really interesting with the whole supernatural aspect of it, and and just the imagery of the Atlantic Ocean I found quite intriguing as well. Often if you ask me about the Atlantic Ocean, I would think of, oh, the movie takes place in off the coast of Massachusetts, or it's in Scotland, the North Atlantic, or something like that. But, you know, this, often you don't think of African countries on the Atlantic Ocean, and I thought the ocean was presented really mysteriously, and it really loomed over the whole picture. And the fact that during the course of it, some of the workers who are desperate, struggling, looking for new opportunities, end up going out into the sea, and they're mysteriously lost at sea looking for new opportunities in Spain. I thought that was an interesting aspect too. The story is something you've seen before, like with two lovers who can't get together because, you know, there's an arranged marriage for the lead character with a wealthy gentleman, and her name's Ada, and her boyfriend Suleiman is, you know, this working class guy who's not getting paid for his labor. He's one of the ones who ends up going out to sea, So we've seen that in a lot of stories, but I don't think I've ever seen anything where it goes from that sort of, you know, stuck in an arranged marriage, not able to be with your true lover, to the sort of ghost story and spiritual story this turns into. So I think it's a very interesting film to watch, and something, yeah, definitely different as far as the Netflix pictures.
Yeah, I'm not sure how Mady Diop would feel about the comparison, but I got a Ken Loach vibe from it, because it's very much about, like, the struggles of the working class and struggles about, like, social class distinctions and how you're trapped by them. And, you know, you can try and make these small moves, and there's kind of still no escape. It's interesting, the 80 Suleiman romance, there's kind of an understanding that they're kind of on a ticking clock, because she's getting married in like 2 weeks, and you know, even her friends are sort of she has this one friend, Miriam, who's like, God is putting Suleiman in your path to tempt you, and she's kind of like the one who's like super devout. And Ada's like, well, it's not like that. She's not, I guess because of the status women hold in the society, she's not like explicitly saying or explicitly talking about like my rights, my, you know, being able to take up, you know, my own authority and pursue things on my own. There's just this quiet resignation that, like, yeah, I know I'm marrying this man, Omar, in a couple of weeks, but, you know, for now, let me have this. Let me just hang out with, you know, Suleiman and all that. And it's painted very sharply in the beginning of the film that, you know, Suleiman doesn't, in terms of future prospects, he's struggling too. And, you know, you see them at, the film opens with this shot of this, like, really exotic-looking futuristic tower that all these workers are working on. But it's kind of like in the middle of nowhere along a highway nobody's using. And it seems like a very direct kind of reference to sort of what's going on in this society that, the wealthy here in Dakar are very much apart from the working class. Because then you get to the working class neighborhoods and it's so busy, like, there's people everywhere, like, there's not enough room for people and trains in sort of the same area either. But, so, you know, for all those reasons, I did get a very Ken Loach vibe of, like, the great, I guess, objectification of the working class, that they have no options, and the only options they have are terrible, and that's, you know, you get all these young men who haven't been paid in months, you know, seeing their only option is like going out on the Atlantic Ocean in a rickety boat and risking their lives to go to some place where, you know, lawfully they'll have trouble finding work. But I mean,
it's interesting because what you're saying,
yeah.
Because it's very realist sort of, tone to it, even though all this supernatural stuff's happening with the spirits and all this. Like, it's still very, I got that too, very sort of like matter of fact about the class struggle and, you know, the romantic struggles. And I thought Ada's friends were very realistic, you know, like there'd be gossiping and talking about Suleiman and, you know, them having their own pressures in their lives. And I thought that was all pretty realistic, but in the backdrop, there's all this sort of spiritual stuff, like with the Atlantic Ocean and with the spirits and the mysterious illness, which happens to the characters, and even like the young detective who's brought in. He's brought in at the start. He's like very much like a police procedural. The way he's brought into it, he's going to solve this case. It's very matter of fact, in, you know, because there's an arson on the rich husband's place, Omar, on the night of the wedding. There's an arson, and this young detective comes into
the marriage bed is literally set on fire.
Yeah, the marriage bed is set on fire. So this young detective comes in, and at the start, and he's suffering from a mysterious illness. Yet he's like, you can tell he's like the superstar detective, and he's, yeah, he's really going by the book, sort of like procedural. It comes a procedural, which is sort of like a realist story as well. So it's interesting how it's juggling. I don't think it was super successful all the time, but it's juggling all these elements of keeping like this sort of realist tone while all these supernatural elements are taking place as well.
Yeah, it's not very straightforward. You know, Dieppe's not really holding your hand, like kind of explaining things. And the only reason you clue in that the young women are possessed by the spirits of the men who are lost at sea, the only reason you kind of clue that in is because they have this like milky white filter over their eyes that kind of like poke out of the dark. It's like a very kind of subtle nod to their possession, and very well done. Like the effect is very well done. But that doesn't happen till about the middle of the movie. And so you sort of like sit through like 45, 50 minutes of this very, as you said, realistic take on life for these people in Senegal and their struggles and, you know, how they're trying to, you know, set themselves apart. And like the interesting class distinction too, because, you know, Ada is kind of, you see this in kind of her, the way she carries herself. She's kind of trapped between like her friends who are kind of more modern thinking. They don't wear hijabs. They don't seem particularly devout. They like to hang out at the beach side bar, which I can't imagine is terribly lawful, but it's, you know, their hangout. And then she has friends like Miriam who, you know, are more devout and, you know, wear the headscarf and all that. And then you come to later in the film when they're all possessed, and they do end up all possessed. They're kind of like, there's kind of an acknowledgement that there's, regardless of who they are and where they come from in this world, they are united in, I guess, the class conflict. And this one businessman who lives in opulence but can't pay his workers for months for some reason, and is probably protected by corrupt influences in his own government. I mean, that's not made explicitly clear. I'm just kind of reading into things. But, you know, they kind of, well, what happens is they're possessed. They go to his house and they demand the funds he never paid them. And what does he do? He goes to the police and says, hey, all these women broke into my house. And the police captain is like, well, we have to get to the bottom of this right away. not get to the bottom of the corruption, how this guy lives in opulence and hasn't paid his workers in months, which again gets into the very Loach kind of mode here, is that, you know, rich people get away with whatever they want, and it's the poor people who, you know, get it from both sides. They're screwed by the people who should be protecting them, screwed by the people who should be paying them. And the quality is there, but I do like what you said about, and this occurred to me when you said it, that about the Atlantic Ocean always being there, because it does seem like they're haunted by it. And there are these, like, these loving shots, and they're just beautiful shots of the ocean, like the waves coming in, and it seems like all set at the golden hour, or the Senegalese equivalent of the golden hour, where it's like this beautiful like golden orange filter on the camera, watching the waves come in. It's like both enticing, but you can also see the power of the ocean in it as well. And there are scenes too where, you know, there's so many scenes where, and the film ends like this too, where you just hear the sound of the waves coming on the beach. It's always there, kind of like this white noise filter on everything that happens. You know, so even before the haunting, you get you very much get a feel that these people are being haunted by the ocean in a real sense.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting the way it's all put together. And yeah, it's one of those films too. You can watch it multiple times, and it still has an effect, because I think it's not like there are like plot twists in a way, but it's not like a film where it's like, oh, don't want to reveal that this happened or this happened, because it's more the way things happen. And that's I think that's a filmmaker like Ken Loach is really into, like, atmosphere and the way things happen. And that's Diop in her debut here is very much like that too. It's a lot about tone, and even though, you know, a lot of strange things are happening, it's not like you're getting shock scares or anything. Or it's like more the tone, and
mm-hmm.
and that actually works with the ocean. It's kind of like the film sort of flows throughout, and it moves throughout, crests throughout, and it's not really, twists and turns. It's more just like the flow of the waves, I guess. And I think that's, it's kind of how it is. And it's interesting because you don't maybe see a lot of movies like this right now that's like purely atmosphere. And they tend to be often, when I see them, often foreign films. And this is a film from Senegal, which is really, really heavy on atmosphere for sure.
Yeah, Disney's not going to be picking up the rights for Atlantics and remaking it with Chris Evans and Ana de Armas or something like that. I just picked them out of thin air, no disrespect to either of those actors. The Loach connection I also felt in the ending, too, because I won't get too much into the ending, but it leaves things very unresolved. Like, it's just like, it just kind of like leaves things, and Ken Loach is like that too. He's very much about the realism. There's no kind of big moment where everybody brings piles of money in to save George Bailey. There's no kind of like catharsis like that. It's just like, the story is over, now we're gonna go back to normal. And although there is sign in the end maybe Ada is changed by the experience. There's a great shot of her at the end. She has this transformation where she doesn't like necessarily make herself up, but in the last scene where she's going to meet the cop who's possessed by Suleiman, where she actually does her hair and does her puts on nice clothes, and they go to meet up for like this sort of last romantic rendezvous, and the last scene is of her kind of like looking at herself in a mirror and kind of like maybe like seeing herself for the first time. And it's not made like explicitly clear what's going to happen from there. Like, does she going to go on and marry or stay married to Omar, or, does she try to strike it out on her own? Like this, cause there's a scene of her like training at the bar. So it's like, she going to work at the bar now with this other woman? I don't know. I will say about poor Omar is that the most you see Omar interested in Ada, and maybe this speaks to the fact that it's like an arranged marriage or whatever, but the most invested he gets in her is like when he has to go and bail her out of the police station when they're questioning her about the fire, and he's very insistent that she come with him, and seems kind of perturbed when she doesn't. And there's only a few scenes with Omar, but it strikes you as interesting that, the only scene where he seems to get emotionally invested in her is when she doesn't, explicitly do what she's told. And then he gets outraged and, he basically says, well, you don't arouse me anyway. I mean, he's a little more explicit like that, but we're on family radio in the middle of the afternoon. But it's strange that that's kind of like his kind of one reaction to her.
Yeah, she's like his possession. And like there's this first scene with him at the bar, he's in that nice bar on the beach there, and he gives her a new iPhone. He's like, well, I wasn't sure what color, but it's going to change your life. And she seems pretty disinterested with it, but to him it's like this material possession that's everyone has. Everyone has to have an iPhone, and
it's status, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's going to change her life, right? And
right, because it's Senegal in the 21st century. Everybody still has cell phones, but he gives her this iPhone, and that's kind of like his only. And it's kind of implied both with Omar and this other fellow who's, was denying the checks. Like, their only understanding of the world is, like, material. The only way he can show affection, can show affection for Ada is to, like, buy her something nice. And it kind of shows, like, classic working class kind of struggle stuff. You know, it's like she's not looking for stuff, which is why she's, you know, with Suleiman at the beginning, she's looking for something greater. I mean, that's kind of a trite reading, but also happens to be true, and also, you know, is part of the whole undercurrent of the movie. And it's interesting, that scene where the workers are in the office, like, saying, where's our paycheck, where's our paycheck? The guy who runs the company isn't there. It's other office workers, and you hear them say, you know, well, we're workers too. Feels a bit parasite-y in that we have, like, two groups of working-class people sort of being left to turn against each other, but I'm not sure the film is really saying anything new about the class divide. I do appreciate, though, the sort of way it, I guess, repurposes ideas of possession. I was reading a lot about the film in terms of, like, are the kind of, like, zombies, not zombies in, like, the Romero sense, but zombies in the old-fashioned, like, Verdun sense, voodoo sense, where they're, like, possessed, they become vessels of people who have passed, like, kind of like jinn in Islamic mythology as well. How it's kind of reclaiming the idea of possession, not as something evil or as something bad, but as something that gives the dead a chance to rectify things they couldn't fix in life. There was one writer, Kelly Weston, in Mubi, who called zombies the original emblem of the African diaspora. And that's kind of that's a direct quote from her piece, how zombies are caught between, like, the living and the dead, the new world and the old world, you know, sort of being a slave to basic instinct, you know, kind of pun intended, and how this kind of reclaims that. Zombie here isn't people being used, but people, you know, using possession and the supernatural to find some sense of justice, whether it's personal justice in the sense of Suleiman, or more material justice in the sense of the workers who are going after the miserly building owner.
Mm. Yeah, it isn't your standard zombie fare, right? Even when they're having him dig their graves, it's not like that horror frightening. It's almost like, you know, just do it. You know, just get this done here for us.
And they tease him as he's digging his grave too, like you know, making fun of him and his frankly his digging abilities, and mocking him for, like, as someone who clearly hasn't had to dig anything ever. He's you know, he has no working class credentials, I guess. He's never had to dig. He's never had to do any, like, hard physical labor in his life. And you're right. It's not very scary. It's kind of like the justice moment. It's like the Scooby-Doo reveal. It's like somebody getting their comeuppance, which is kind of how it's played.
Yeah, it's played more. Yeah, they're getting the comeuppance. It's more like, let's laugh at this. Let's laugh at this bourgeois man who can't hold a shovel, kind of thing, right? And that's what that's played for. Yeah, I thought. There's overall, like, a lot of the themes we've seen before, they're fairly straightforward, but I just thought the way it was all put together was something that was unique, and I'm interested to see what the director does in her next films, because I think there was in here, like, there's all these, like, almost like mini films in here. Like, there could have been a detective story and it was just a small part, and there could have been a fuller ghost story, but that was sort of a smaller part, and then there's a class component, like you said, that probably took up over half the film. But just, I'm interested to see what she does next after this. I thought, but it's definitely something to watch that, you know, is like stuff you've seen before in the themes, but unlike in just, I think, the way it's all constructed and put together, and the setting as well.
Yeah, the technical aspects of the movie are great. Did you see Portrait of a Lady on Fire? Because the cinematographer for Portrait of a Lady on Fire is the same cinematographer for Atlantics. It's Claire Mathon. Yeah. So I'm now a really big fan of hers. Not that I wasn't before, when after seeing Portrait of a Lady on Fire, but she's really great at capturing this sort of realistic vibe, like using very naturalistic lighting. There's scenes in it that are like fairly dark. I don't mean dark as in theme, but you know, dark in terms of lighting. Reminded me a lot of the big bonfire scene in Portrait of a Lady on Fire too, where it seems like the only light there is coming from the bonfire. She's really good at sort of exploiting that naturalistic light and really making you feel like you're there. And one of the things I felt in this too is that the camera is like gets in really close at times. There's a really great kind of intimacy, and there that was the same with Portrait of a Lady on Fire too. You felt really like you could feel the heat coming off the actors almost at certain times. It's just she's really really good, and like talk about people who you want to see have bigger careers going forward. And then I also want to highlight Fatima Al-Khariri, or Khatiri, who did the Fatima Al-Khariri, who did the music for the film too, which is they combine like electronic plus like kind of some old fashiony African rhythms too. Like there's a really great scene where the workers are driving back from the tower, and it's all this lengthy drive, which goes to show you, like, part of the problem is, you know, they're having to do this long commute to a place that doesn't pay them every day, but it's just this very hypnotic scene where you sort of watch Suleiman in the back, and the workers are kind of singing, but he's not, he's kind of just getting lost in the ride. But one of the things that sort of makes this scene very hypnotic is the score, which doesn't have like a sort of distinctive sound one way or the other. It's just like this very hypnotic kind of vibe that kind of like puts you in his mindset. And looking back, it's kind of like maybe this is the scene where he decides he's going to get out of there, where he's had enough. And this is why he's sort of like anxious to get back to Ada and, you know, have this afternoon, because he knows like, tonight's the night I'm getting the heck out of here. I've had enough. There's got to be something better out there than getting in the back of this truck every day.
Yeah, it seems. Yeah, that's an interesting point there. It seems like he's in a trance there. Yeah, everyone else, they're all angry, right? They haven't been paid for months for this work on this futuristic tower, like you said, Adam. And they're in the back of the truck, and they're all angry at the certain. Then they start breaking out in the song. They're like, "Oh, what? Oh, well, we're gonna sing here." And he's still
just another day.
Yeah, he's like, he's had enough at that point, I think. And it's interesting when they're driving, because you can see the ocean in the background, and it's really, really well done. And the points about the cinematographer, that's really, really cool that you mentioned that. I didn't know she did both of those, but you can see the similarities, because there is sort of like a bonfire scene in this film as well, right? The one where the night of the wedding, and you can see. And it's a plot point where you can see a spirit in when the police are reviewing the footage. You have that. And I think of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. There's a scene where they want to go swimming and out in the water. And it seemed similar in this as well. And I think, yeah, the Portrait of a Lady on Fire, yeah, probably one of my most favorite things about that is the cinematography. So I'm hoping cinematographer has a long career, because great job in this as well. I think it definitely adds to the whole atmosphere, just the camera work and the score too. It's just it's a film that you just sort of take it in, as opposed to really, you know, think about a lot of what's happening, but you sort of more take it in, I think, and it's something you can watch multiple times, which I really appreciate. As opposed to plot point A to point B to point C type films, which have their place too. But like you said, if this was done by Hollywood, it might end where, you know, the women take over the mansion, right? As opposed to,
right,
you know, they take over the wealthy man's mansion, and then that's the end of the film or something. So I like the way this this all flowed and how there's so much ambiguity with it. And I think, like you said, the music and the camera work only adds to that.
Yeah, it's more lyrical. It's kind of more song-like. You know, it's this is a horrible comparison, but it's like Leader of the Pack. It's doomed to end in tragedy, and you sort of get that sense. And all you can do is like kind of hope to find some sort of personal resolution, I guess. It's interesting. It's interesting to. And I said this last week with Candace doing Satanic Panic. It's interesting that the quarantine has sort of forced me anyway, in terms of these interactions with you and the others, to sort of find things that I probably wouldn't click play on myself. It's just sort of I have no idea whether or not Atlantics would have come up, like, in terms with the algorithms on Netflix. If it would just be like, hey, check this out on its own. But, I mean, that's kind of been one of the particular, shall we say, delights of the pandemic is at least for me, is like discovering great things I probably wouldn't have discovered on my own. And I think I might have liked Atlantics a little bit better than you. I was kind of okay with just like letting it be the leaf, the proverbial leaf on the wind, and letting the movie take me where it wanted to take me. You know, it's I think it's a very rewarding film. It's a very beautiful film. It's a culture that isn't terribly familiar, but I mean, having said that, there's a lot of cultural things, a lot of cultural commonalities. There's a lot of stuff that in the film that I think don't feel foreign, even if it is a foreign film. And it's very touching in a lot of ways. And I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, I'm glad you watched it too, Adam. I can help you, because your algorithms are all telling you to watch The Ridiculous Six, right? That's what was. No,
I have been doing a Sandler rewatch, and that is an inside joke that we brought up before we started recording, so people can enjoy that.
algorithms are tough, right? It's yeah, that's the thing about Netflix. It's good to dig deep, because there's quite the library in there. It's just, you have to dig for it. And myself, hope in the coming weeks you can open my eyes up to a few things as well.
Well, we will see. I have been doing a binge watch of Blindspot, which is this ridiculous show about a woman with tattoos that solve crimes. The tattoos lead to crimes that the FBI has to solve. So that's what I've been watching, aside from Atlantic. So, take that what you will. Tim, if people want to go deeper with you, how can they find you on the internet?
You can find me Flash in the Deadpan on social media. That would be Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email me at flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com.
And that is it for this week's show. We hoped you liked it, and if you want to listen to the show again, you can of course find us on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.ca. And if I could just sort of pause here for a minute before signing off on the show, I wanted to say a general thanks to Christopher and Jenny at CFRU for keeping things going at this difficult time, making sure the station stays running, even though there's barely anyone on campus, and certainly no one in the station physically right now, aside from occasional pop-ins by the staff to keep things running. Also, I want to salute my fellow programmers who are continuing up their shows from home. It's different, it's sometimes strange, and sometimes difficult, but we're all very dedicated volunteers to CFRU, and we hope you have been enjoying that programming and have been listening along as we've been trying to navigate through this crisis. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all for staying with us here on CFRU, and there will be more great programming coming up here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m., of course, for more end credits, and we will see you then.